Save big money on everything for your next project at Menards. Spring is here, making it the perfect time for outdoor projects. Suncast storage sheds are an excellent solution for protecting outdoor lawn and gardening tools. They're easy to assemble, and the all-weather construction provides water resistance and UV protection. Save big on Suncast storage sheds. View our selection of Suncast products today in-store and on Menards.com. Save big money at Menards.
Sean O'Reilly was born on the 1st of August in Cork, 1931. He grew up where traditional music was the living music of the people. His father from Clare was an enthusiastic traditional fiddle player, and his great-grandfather was a farmer, poet and sculptor, and had translated the Odyssey into Irish, which was never published, however. His mother's family came from County Cork and claimed descent from the Macridons, whose names are on the Dalwhy Harp of 1621. Sean O'Reilly was educated at the Christian Brothers in Adair, County Limerick, and subsequently read classics in University College Cork and studied piano under Alois Fleischmann Sr., in whose memory the beautiful Huldrun songs were written. After graduation in 1952, he became assistant director of music at Radio Éireann, leaving there after only 18 months in order to study in Italy and Paris. Some of his own piano compositions were broadcast from Paris Radio in 1954. After returning to Ireland, he became director of music at the Abbey Theatre. O'Reilly's most significant work was composed, or at least had its origins, in the period around 1956-57. In 1958, he gave a series of 14 lectures on RTE entitled A Musical Heritage. In 1960, he was commissioned by Galen to write the music for the film Misha Eire. The Song of the Anvil, a play by Brian McMahon, produced at the Abbey Theatre in 1961, was the occasion that brought Sean O'Reilly the first into contact with some of the musicians who formed Ciúltóirí Chulainn. Lovers of traditional music gathered in his house in Dublin's Galloping Green each week to play and dance on the wooden floor, which he had specially strengthened from below for that purpose. From these sessions came Ciúltóirí Chulainn, with whom he claimed he changed the sound of traditional instrumental music. At the same time, O'Reilly changed his own life too, relearning Irish with awesome thoroughness and soaking up the old traditions, a process which was to see him loading up his family one day and driving to Dunqueen in the Kerry Gaeltacht. In 1964, he was appointed Cork Corporation Lecturer in Irish Music in University College Cork. And in order to identify himself more closely with the living language and the people, he took a house in Coolay, west of Macroom, and from there travelled to Cork each day for lectures, to Dublin for his many broadcasts, TV appearances, recording sessions and concert work. In this programme we examine O'Reilly's family life in Coolay and his relationship with the local community. In another programme we will deal with his music during those years. Sean the Hora, singer and raconteur, was a close friend of O'Reilly. Here he talks to producer Pat Feely about the purchase of the house in Coolay.
Anna gerði það horka kjánuku, agað fjömmar við þar við tí kín tí tí svoðsinn úrsinn. Ach, hvað mörg síðis og skömmir stakhans að tíksa hér tíg, gúlega. Sann ég tíg bráða bæða. Pjánir sem sinni ís, skömmir hvað ég það var hér ná tæði. Ach, það var hvað þú tíkóla sér gótt, tóga ég sín. Vím verið sann ég þurr mun fætt. Æm lýsinn dæði gæli, skömmir stakhans við tíginn dí kjáin, Di balna xoqayga tsun, tsun vi mali xo xoayna kona yin uvarsin. Shni yin banga gana shan tigwa hin. As gini dana marga ernaya giyad. Punt. Bil hana min diya qogur. Suud had milni bu mbrugu. Nun tikshini gishawan gulayni bu. Tig bira wa shaya.
In fact, I can remember well, I was there the day that he got word that he had got the job in UCC. And I met him that evening and he told me that he had got a job in UCC and he said, I don't know what I'll do now because I'd love to stay here in Ballyferrother and travel to Cork every day, but that's impossible, he said. And then sure, if I get a house and stay in Cork and stay there, to just Dublin all over again. It's the same thing. And he asked me, tell me, he says, is there any house in Coolay? It is near enough to Cork. And I told him, actually, that there was. That Donald Kilcahan's house had been for sale for a few years. And that I'm sure would be easy to buy it. And actually, the following day, himself and Sean the Horror and Sean Kivan in Ballyferrother are in Greig. They went to Marnie Kilcahan, lived in Ballincollig at the time. They went to Coolay and looked at the house. I went from that to Ballincollig, and he bought the house from her that night.
O'Riordan was a national figure when he came to Coolay. He and his group, Kyolthary Coolan, had swept the country with their new sound. He was appearing regularly on television and broadcasting frequently on the radio. His arrival created a stir. Early on, he became involved not only in the cultural life, but also in the economic life of the community. Micheál Leonard is a local teacher.
Mar gine agus mar cósa agus mar air a raibh leas a phobail go mór ige de bhag sé deachar a thar ó. Bhí sé a gón í ag a cuíne bhar flanana con an áit a chur a raig ní raibh tóra leis an méid scéamana a bhí ina ceann ige. De chur sé cuidiúcha chun críthe Nir varshe kun berir nikin bvo akhur kun kie no if you while no has no accident says the navy on the varshe gor gor begin da ve janam na mas gon I ni han de hin ach da horsin agus den de week harter kule bare vol agus art an archin
Cén sort dearca a bhí ag muinte na háite ar nuair a tháina sé go dtíon áit an céadúir?
Ní chuoine mé sin inis agus fear a chuaigh a bhaidhm go mór ar a lán daoine an thapaig. Mar bhí an cumas sin i gé. Bhí se abal déiláile agus láirt lá in déir mí féin sa clí gur higad ré. Dwi eisiau ddor o ciol y stoc o gharau agos fwrs e reisio dy awn agos dy hys bain se dy fwy'n tynnaid I gref mas I ge i'r rhywbeth agos mar sy'n dy un ydw'r talaf cymont o leis golwa
Codi na roddi a rinna si an sio chiapant o ffein na roddi y smor rinna si an sio na rwy sy'n gwanhau sio
I think the coigse fein vas in snadini margini gaeltata vi seis folos taga sanait nur hanische vi roint dini unt kama in sanait le tamal mor no so I'm sure an doctor Olinchig tsachniische inischen hanig donak yakhain Fær vi gafur fein kunnur agus fein kosti dækis munti ál veringa. Dæk mætti sinni nabur að sjúl hók sér dýnig dýn hrækt að sí agus da vjók dýn sé að vjók dýnd er en dafskil. Agus hosnig dýn í iskri fyrir jökta agus da spræk sé an sæl gælach áhúir man er dyrfa. Núra hannig sé vi an kjókánach imi hei gígur inna híg alunig sé. At Connor, agus an oin remission vi prunchis a chala ian moran coma ach vi follow us on capim nora hanig se agus vi dirug an aim sure abig nora hanig se valig dini harter agus to kona kider gur higi se iad agus gunianach se I cwrdd o'r rhaeg yn sgachom o'r ddyn. Cwyn i'n er gahare mae'r corsa ffonta. Fer anna môr chrioch fi awn. Dwi'n meddwl sy'n hana. Ac dy faliwch se na ddyn i crin o gahare harter. Ddyn i bedyr ar y bwon y spesiol o hef na tangon agos o hef sgeliwch agos mae sy'n bod teb mwy di sy'n erfad fi anna fwaig I gyd y gwyni na'r eff coma as agos siandyn I gyhaer I he Bydd eisiau gwni sy'n tigi ge. Fy wain y gas y wain. Dy hog sy'n sianar. Fy y tip. Fy ddach yn hei hen. Cynnau o'ch o'r achos yr eisiau ddyn. Sy'n yn saith dyn i fi o'n. Y gwni i ddyn o'n ymasa. Y gwni i ffyr i'r fi o'n rydw o'n caerwyd. Nor y marg i ychdwyd. Rydw i ddyn tor chyn. Cwrsia tŵsle be. Bwchwys y stoel ym lesion erdwys. Lesion forbert. Mor tŵns gleiwch dy hosnig yn sa yn sy'n na siasgyd i ddian o'ch ni'r y ffaicyn sa o hef tŵns gwyl fi cwrwgyn fi eislawiwch dy'n sa'r ffaic fe blian a ddi'r i ffosdiwch dy fela gobal y fwrna agos fi tepori fi yr hef da stiwch agos yr hef da orbert fi ar siwle gieltr y cnosa hartar hen hws y galf yn wrwyd agos ni fwr mae'r ffaic yma le fwr gyda i gyrhanig sian o'r iddo.
Well, I think this is generally known. It seems that probably because people didn't understand about him or were misinformed about his ability or some such thing, he would seem to be a threat to certain people, that he would oust them, we'll say, from their position or the limelight in which they had up to then enjoyed. And I think it was only after he died, really, that some of them came to understand what it was all about.
Was it the question of a big fish from the outside world coming into the small pool of Coolay?
Yes, possibly that. I think this is a thing that happens in small communities. They don't like people coming in to upset the apple cart, and they think that, people have some different motives to what they have. And I think in this way that it was completely unjustified as far as I'm concerned. I regret that this was the way when he came here first.
The Oireadas were in Coolay about 6 months when Morini Huluan, a local girl, came to work for the family. Except for some temporary periods of disagreement, she was with them for the rest of Oireadas' life, and as she lived in, she had a good inside view of life in the house.
Oh, he was in Coolay some 6 months, I'd say, when I first started working for Sean Oireadh. That was directly after I leaving school. And he needed a maid, so I was taken on, without any interviews, just as I was, do the housework, that's all he wanted. And if I was happy, he was happy. So we had no problems in the line of who do this or who do that. I had responsibility of the house, and he managed the rest himself.
And what did you do?
Oh, I done all the ordinary housework, and see to his family, see to the meals, and keep the place tidy as you could with 7 kids. It wasn't very easy, but he wasn't very particular once you just got over and done with it. And he didn't really mind, not anything in particular. He'd never ask you anything in particular. Only on occasions he would decide that he should rise out and do a little skewered around the house, and that was just to make contact with everything he had, he owned, and if anything was missing, well, I was the one to blame, or I had him mislaid him, so I'd go and he'd return again and be taken back again after a small short length of time. But he would never apologise or say he was wrong. I was to come back up when he would ask me, and that was it.
But this happened fairly often. You often left and gave up the job. And
very often. More times than I can remember. But he would come back again, like if anyone did call or he was needed. And to many you would get, like, to be put up with the cabal that was there a lot of times. They had lots of parties and different things that would need settling out for. But he would come back just the same as I'd go back to him.
There was one story about the Kenwood chef. Could you tell us that story?
Oh, that I'll tell you. They did get a new Kenwood chef, the latest model, and it was my business to wash it and to put it away. And on one occasion, a little rubber that was fitting in underneath it, I placed it in one end, and the following time I used it, the rubber was missing. And I was the one that had mislaid it. I hadn't the courage to tell him, maybe I put it on the other end, Sean, or if we try the rubber this way, it might work. So the rubber did go missing, and the machine wouldn't work. He wouldn't even put it going for herself to give me the benefit of the doubt. And I got my week's notice, and I quit there and then. I'd never work out the week. I should go there and then, like. I wouldn't give him the satisfaction. And after a length of time, he'd return again, and the Kenwood chef had been working, but he wouldn't give in that the rubber should be turned around. We'd never mention the problem or speak with it again. It'd be all over and forgotten until he'd decide again to raise another cabal about something. And you'd get on fine with him, provided you knew his ups and downs, and don't threaten him when he weren't feeling himself. That was mostly in foggy weather. He didn't like foggy weather.
Why did he put up the red light?
The red light was put up to keep us quiet when he was composing music. He had his own study built after the house, an entrance from the kitchen, and when he'd go down, we more than likely never thought Sean was doing anything in particular, or that he'd need any peace and quiet, so he decided to put up a red bulb over the door of his study. And that bulb would be lighting if we made a tickle, including herself, God rest her soul. The two of us would be a run out of the house until he'd be finished his day's work. Then we could talk on again. But if we did speak while it was on, he'd come up and let you know you did speak.
Would he actually put you outside the door?
Or he'd just come up and tell you, like, could you get any better time to decide to talk or to raise a cabal about anything, including his family? 'Tis then things had got to the devil altogether, no, and you'd want him quietness, like. You would really and truly forget there was such a thing as quietness. And when he'd switch off the bulb, we could be back again to ourselves. And that was a lot of noise and a lot of cabal around the place all the time. But they were very happy, and they had a big family, and he was head of the household. And it was until the day he did die.
And there was an incident in the house while you were there involving an oak stool.
There was. He had an oak stool inside the table. Long table to seat all nine of them down together, or ten of us. And the five youngest were inside the table having dinner. He was on the outside with Ruth, where he usually sat. And they decided they'd have some battle of something or another, and the stool fell down and it fell on his toe, where he had to have his toe lanced sometime after. It got very sore, and he just asked him, see, Kaganation, and they all just answered me, Michigan, and he'd never ask any more, just look for the timber spoon, and lined up the four or five of them that were inside the table along by the banister of the stairs, and took them in one by one as their ages came along, and gave them a doing over inside in the sitting room with the timber spoon, and left them off. And then he could tell them, let you figure out between you who did knock the stool. And that was it. Then they were really afraid, didn't they? And it was a great way for him to have his family. They honoured and respected him, and that is what did make him a happy family. He was boss, and if they'd done anything out of the way, it was his authority to give them the timber spoon.
Rachel, O'Riordan's daughter, was 15 when her father died. She remembers him in a different way.
Like, I can remember the two of us were always kind of competing. We'd have a little game whereby he'd stick out his hand, you know, his knuckles like that, and I'd hit his knuckles back, you see, and we'd be at that for hours, you know, and of course he'd hurt me, but I wouldn't give in. Like, we used to have races out, you know, running up and down the road as well, and if I ever beat him, I was allowed a half a crown, but I never did, and I'd keep on challenging him to a race up and down the road, you see, but I never won. I always thought the day would come when I did, but never came. And lots of little stories like that. They're the things that stand out in my mind, really, about him.
He had an adventurous streak and maybe even a childish streak that would probably appeal to children. I mean, the fact that he would get involved in races and that sort of thing is an indication.
When we were sitting around the table and drinking tea and so on, he used to play lots of little games with us, like... he'd say, and kid in the Laurig no Garig no Spanig, Eokla, Madano, Ornstuch, Ain, or E. So we'd all been sitting around there trying not to titter and so on, keeping our lips shut, and of course somebody burst out, or there was another one, you were not allowed to say Tha or Neil or Sharon ni Han your conversation, he'd be bound to catch you out. That was when he was in good humour. Of course, when he was in bad humour, he'd say, until Laurig no Garig no Spanig, Eokla, Gosha, Batteral, which would mean a different thing entirely.
Now, in the years before he died, you were in fact a student in a boarding school.
I was.
Could you describe what that was like?
He promised me that if I ever really wanted to leave the place, that you know I could and so on. But the letters were always opened when we were sending them home. We couldn't close our letters, so he gave me this little rhyme that I could write in my letter so that he'd know I wanted to leave the place. And will I tell you the?
Yes.
It was. It was actually out of an old story. It comes a lot into these old Skilte Finichte, which he used to read for us when we were smaller. And it's Vien Larvan, Adolfescan, Chupoge, Sunkopoge, Tehuhe, Madri, Garagostrix, Night Namidish, Snight Nabidish, Nilardish, Necher. But I never used it, even though I was very tempted to do it on a lot of occasions, but I didn't. I had more of an inclination to do so when he was dead, really. There was, you know, I was stuck there then, I suppose, and there was no way out.
What did you know about his work as a child?
Well, I didn't know an awful amount about what he was doing. I didn't know that it was very exceptional. Of course, I realised that when I was about 12, I suppose, that there was something important about his work. He used to play his records, and he did a lot of tapes that he'd be playing at night time when we were in bed. And we used to kind of sing along. I'd be in one room and Padder in the other, and we'd be kind of trying to best each other at the singing and so on while we were listening to the tapes. So that all the stuff is in my head, I suppose, a lot of the tapes that he would have at the time.
What do you think his work was about? Did you see him as a teacher or as a composer or as a musician? What picture did you have of him?
I suppose I thought of him as a composer, really. It was a thing that never... I just accepted him for what he was without thinking about it. I used to have problems in school, actually. Sometimes people, you know, I'd nearly be embarrassed about it at times because other girls kind of used to kind of taunt me by saying, of course, you can get away with murder because you're Sean O'Riordan's daughter, you see, and I didn't... You know, sometimes I felt that I'd prefer to be incognito rather than feel that, you know, that I was getting any special favours because of him. But I suppose I became proud of him later on. Then, you know, I changed my view about that. But I knew that our house was kind of different from other households as well.
In what way?
Well, we'd have lots of parties and so on, and... we'd have a lot of other people coming in, and I suppose we didn't have the same customs they might have in other households, like they had around here at the time, whereby they'd all have the rosary in their households and so on, which we didn't have. I remember one time I was a little bit embarrassed about that, and I made Owen, my younger brother, go up to the room with me, and for about two nights, you know, the two of us, you know, I thought this was an awful thing that we weren't saying the rosary, and I got him to say the rosary with me once or twice, but we gave it up as a bad job afterwards. Like, I was always afraid that he was going to die young. I used to try and imagine what he'd be like as an old man, and I couldn't picture him at all. So I used to pray when I was young, and I had a strong, I suppose, a religious outlook that time from school and so on. This was when I was very small. I suppose before I was 10 anyway, when I was 8 or 9. And I kind of noticed that he wasn't going to communion. Of course, he used to be playing the harmonium anyway, so he wouldn't leave that, I suppose, to go up to communion. I don't know. I never knew why he didn't, but I used to pray that he would. But I got afraid that if he actually did have communion, that God above would call him to himself, because that he'd be too good for this earth. I don't know where I got that kind of a cockeyed view, but that's what I thought. So I gave up praying that he'd go to communion, and I just used to pray that he'd live until he'd be 100 instead at that stage.
Living in the country, O'Riordan developed an interest in rural pursuits, shooting, fishing and boating. Padre O'Riordan.
I remember one of the highlights of that period was a big clay pigeon shoot they had done in Conbarn's field. How we call Conbarn's, it's Muitulwasa on it. And they were banging away for hours down there, and we arrived en route and the rest of the family. And we saw all these gentlemen arriving up, and they're blasting away in pairs, and it came to Sean's turn. And I remember watching Mick Sullivan, Mihala Sullivan, that man that wrote Where Mountain Men Have Sown, one of the great strong men around here, who, you know, one of the men of history, who was a fantastic shot, and he just banged away and knocked everything out of the sky and seemed fantastic. And then Sean's turn came up, and he went up with his gun and said, pull. And there was a couple of bangs and no hit. And it continued on like this, and I remember being mortified and getting very embarrassed about it. He didn't hit it even once. He didn't take any notice of it. I mean, that was sort of as well as if he'd hit the whole bloody lot of them. Like,
didn't knock a feather out of him.
No.
Then he went through a sort of a fishing phase as well, or he was interested in fishing, I suppose, where he was interested in mortals.
He was, yeah. Well, his father used to do a lot of fly fishing, and with the river close by here, of course, we used to go down fishing. But he had fly rods and flies and so on, and he used to wear a tweed cap with flies, with feathers stuck in the cap, and our hat. And I remember one occasion we went down to the river, the two of us, on a summer's evening. It was a beautiful evening. The midges weren't out, you know, which was a blessing around here. And we were fishing away, and Sean was always very pishogach. I'd say it was something that ran in the family. And I remember this big bumble sort of flew along lazily down the sort of over the water, and Sean was watching his hair. He had his hat thrown off this time, he wasn't wearing any hat, and he watched the bee, and the bee was sort of flying around in circles. Now Sean was casting away with the fly and throw it into the river, and nothing was biting, of course. And he was casting away, and the next thing I noticed were these two bats flying around as well. And I didn't take any notice until the next thing I heard an awful kip of the reel going on. One of them had swallowed one of the flies that Sean had on the cast, and was tied onto the rod, and he flying around. And of course, a bat is the last thing that, you know, one wants to get caught in their hair, especially if they're pishogach, makes it even worse. So Sean was there, and the bat was flying around like the hammers of hell, and the next thing this bloody bumblebee arrived upstream again and got caught in his hair. So Sean thought that the bat had got caught in his hair, and I remember pandemonium. In the end, the bat broke loose and got away, and we arrived up home. But it was a beautiful evening. I remember that evening very well. But he used to get photographed then and interviewed and everything like that. If somebody arrived to do something for television or radio or paper or something like that, he'd insist on being fishing at the time, you know. There are photographs there in the box of photographs of with Colm O'Loughlin, and he fishing down the river, and big waders on him and all that sort of thing. And the same way with the shooting, he used to go around with the gun over the open shotgun over his arm, sort of thing, and walking down the side of a mountain or something. He was very interested in boating for a while, and he used to get all the yachting magazines, and he had this boat which he bought from Phil Arthur in Kinmare. And he bought a hooker in Galway as well, which he never had a chance to sail down, because he bought it the year he died.
Where was his income coming from in those times?
I don't know. It just used to arrive from out of nowhere. He was never paid properly for anything, because he was never a man that chased for money. And I remember, like, the ridiculous situation afterwards when we were sort of trying to get things together. They were in an awful mess. There was big debts in the bank, but there was an awful lot of cheques that had never been cashed, thrown in amongst newspapers or in amongst books or something like that, which had to be all gathered up and traced and so on, and the dates changed so that they could be used. There was actually more money in the end than he had overdrawn the bank, but it was quite a hefty amount. And even I remember a couple of months ago we were going through some papers and out fell a cheque from 1965 for 200 and something pounds, which was quite a lot that time, which had never been cashed.
Did he make any money out of his music?
No.
Any real money?
No, not really. He, you know, he never really chased it. He made music, he made money, all right, on maybe he'd get £100 or whatever it was, but he never got any big money out of royalties or anything like that while he was alive. All that area was very sort of unsure at that time, all the whole question of royalties and so on, and especially in Irish music. So he was never really worried about it as long as there was enough there to buy something in. I mean, he always used to seem to find it somewhere.
O'Riordan was interested in other art forms as well as music, and his house in Coolay attracted artists and writers who were in the area.
I remember a lot of people coming. Richard Murphy came, I remember distinctly, when they were doing the Battle of Aughrim there. He had written a long poem, which was, I thought, very good at the time. I remember thinking about that at the time, even though I didn't understand it very well. And Sean was doing the music for that. They're going to put a backing on it. I think he used harpsichord afterwards. And he was here, he used to come quite often for a while. There used to be friends of his out from Cork, but obviously he used to meet quite a lot of these people in Cork, so that they didn't have to come out that often. I remember another day when Professor Fleischman arrived out here. They were doing an index together, indexing this huge index. They had an idea of making an index of all the Irish, you know, known Irish songs and tunes and so on, dance music and so on. And they had spent years and years and years. Professor Fleischman had spent years in it, and then Sean got involved, and they'd spent years in it, and they revised the whole method of calculating the whole thing. And I don't think it's finished yet. And Professor Fleischman used to arrive out here to do some work with Sean, probably because Sean mightn't do it if he was left to his own devices. So I remember one very, very nasty wet day that Professor arrived out in a scooter. He had a scooter that time. And we had a meal. He had a meal here, and he did his work with Sean. And in the evening, I remember there was a grand fire in the sitting room, and saying, "My God, that poor man will have to cycle back to Cork again on his scooter." And he went out in his big. He had a trench coat, I remember, and the motorbike wouldn't start. So Sean had a big black Zephyr V6 at the time, and we all went out and we got the car. The car started, and we turned. Professor put the motorbike out in the road, and Sean came up behind the motorbike and put the bumper to the motorbike and revved up the car and sailed off into the wild blue yonder. Professor up on the motorbike with his coat going in the breeze and the rain, and the big black car pushing it to start it on the road on the way into Cork. But it was it was one of those things that quite happened quite frequently. It didn't seem very out of place at the time, but looking back on it, it seems sort of as if it belonged to a different sort of dream world altogether.
He was a great reader and lover of books, and had built up a large library. His books are still in the house and range from philosophy to politics to French literature, Jewish humour and the Greek classics.
What you see on the shelves there is only a small proportion, really, because all the sort of light reading, I suppose you'd call it, is stored up in the attic or thrown into boxes all around the house. Or usually... regularly, every 2 or 3 months, he would gather big boxes of books that he had read, and he'd bring them into a second-hand bookshop and flog them in return for more books. I don't remember seeing him myself buying books very often, but an uncle of mine was telling me recently that it was an experience to go into a bookshop with him, because he would just walk through the bookshop, picking up books as he went that he hadn't read before, and walk with maybe a dozen under his arm up to the cashier and buy them just like that, without ever perusing through them or anything, that he'd know what he wanted. And apparently this was done on a weekly basis. There's a lot of, as you can see yourself, the cross-section of books is very, very wide. I mean, it goes from books in different languages to books in every field of interest, really, which sort of followed his own interests as he went through life, that I can remember anyway. You can see over in the corner there are all the books on sort of fishing and hunting and all that sort of thing, and you can see books on history about them sort of thing, and you know, live biographical works. You can see sort of French books when he sort of probably went through that phase when he was in Paris that time. I suppose maybe he was sort of on a French binge that time. And you can see, you know, they follow different areas through his life when he's interested in those things. I noticed from here, I see just one thing that reminds me there. There was, you see, there's some big fat American books there about from Buckley and a few more of these people who were involved in politics during the McCarthy era in America. And I remember he had a course in UCC with Professor Fleischman for Irish Americans on Professor Owen. Owen McKiernan was running it.
Yes.
And he got into some hectic arguments at that time with some of those people who were rather uncompromising in their ideas. And I remember loads of books coming to the house after that for quite a while with all these big tomes about good reading suggested for Sean O'Rea, this sort of thing, change his mind. I don't think he ever even opened them.
Like others before him, O'Riordan believed that the cultural and economic life of the Gaeltachts were interdependent, and that the music and folk traditions would not flourish, nor indeed survive, without an economic superstructure. He therefore set about improving the economic aspect of life in the Cork Gaeltacht. As a result of his endeavours, a factory was built in Ballyvourna, and another, which gave employment to 40, was brought to Coolay. He also believed in encouraging and helping existing crafts or small businesses. Matty Toomey, a local man, had been building trailers in Coolay since the 1940s when O'Riordan arrived.
I was going to apply for a grant for to start building trailers. And there was a grant going at the time of £350 or something at a workshop. So I approached Sean. I just said it to him simple. So he said, no, he said, don't go for that. He said, there's no use. We'll get the Gaeltachtreadan grant. And I look after that, he said. So he brought it on the farm. And he said, Wednesday, he said, meet, come down to my house at 3 o'clock. And there's a Gaeltachtreadan man coming down, and we'll thrash it out. And there and then, we filled the farm and sent off, and I got my grant. Thanks to Sean.
As you know, Gaeltachts were at that time even very undeveloped, and many factories and so on came in there since. Of course, it was government policy and so on was more or less shaping towards this kind of a thing at the time, but O'Riordan certainly saw it and pressed it, you know, and was involved in trying to form cooperatives and, you know, getting people to apply for grants which they were justified in getting and so on, you know, this kind of a thing. Did that help his music or not? Well, it's hard to say. I suppose it couldn't really help it, but then again he felt that his own idea was smutten tan aishun gaelach vien sol, you know, that it was a part of the old Irish nation, like the old Irish nation we'll consider like that came down, we'll say, from it ended officially, we'll say, at the Battle of Kinsale, but he felt that it still existed in remote areas, and he felt that without a strong economic foundation, that it was bound to disappear, because, well, he could see it locally, like that. I mean, maybe over 50% of school children up to that period were going to England, and the Irish was going with them, and the people who were left around speaking Irish were old people, and he knew that when they'd go, well, the tradition would go and disintegrate.
To the casual observer, O'Riordan's life in Coolay was many-sided and well-rounded, perhaps too well-rounded. There was a certain amount of role-playing going on, and he doesn't seem to have been completely at ease in some of the parts. So, was all of this an attempt to escape from something? Was he fleeing from the desk and the loneliness of creative work, or from something else, something within himself? In a further programme,